Shri Guru Shri Yuta Parakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavam Ta Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Vanchakapa Jubhischa Kripasandabhyevata Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namo Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. January 11th, 2016, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9. Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy, Text 8. Shutrit tridat dubirima muharajamana Sitoshnavata varshair itarecharatcha Kam agniachutaruso chasubur barena Sampasyatomana uru kramasid hateme Kshut, hunger. Trit, thirst. Tridatu bi, three humors, namely mucus, bile, and wind. Imaha, all of them. Muhu, always. Arjamanaha, perplexed. Sita, winter. Ushna, summer. Vata, wind. Varshahai, by rains. Itara itarat, and many other disturbances. Cha, also. Kama agnina, by strong sex urges. Achuta rusha, indefatigable anger. Cha, also. Sudurbarena, most unbearable. Sampasyata, so observing. Manaha, mind. Urukrama, O great actor. Siddhate, becomes despondent. May, my. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O great actor, my lord, all these poor creatures are constantly perplexed by hunger, thirst, severe cold, secretion, and bile, and attacked by coughing winter, blazing summer, rains, and many other disturbing elements, and overwhelmed by strong sex urges and indefatigable anger. I take pity on them, and I am very much aggrieved for them. Purport. A pure devotee of the Lord, like Brahma, and persons in his disciplic succession, are always unhappy to see the perplexities of the conditioned souls who are suffering the onslaughts of the threefold miseries which pertain to the body and mind, to the disturbances of material nature, and to many other such material disadvantages. Not knowing adequate measures for relieving such difficulties, suffering persons sometimes pose themselves as leaders of the people, and the unfortunate followers are put into further disadvantages under so-called leadership. This is like a blind man's leading another blind man to fall into a ditch. Therefore, unless the devotees of the Lord take pity on them and teach them the right path, their lives are hopeless failures. The devotees of the Lord who voluntarily take the responsibility of raising the foolish materialistic sense enjoyers are as confidential to the Lord as Lord Brahma. Shutrit tridat dubir ima murhar arjamanaha Shitosnavata varashar itar e taracha kam agniachutarusha chatudur barena sampasyato mana uru kramasiddhate me. O great actor, my lord, all these poor creatures are constantly perplexed by hunger, thirst, severe cold, secretion, and bile, attacked by coughing winter, blasting summer rains, and many other disturbing elements, and overwhelmed by strong sex urges and indefatigable anger. I take pity on them, and I am very much aggrieved for them. So, these miseries of the material life, that made me think of where, in prayers by the demigods for Lord Krishna in the womb, where they also talk about these material suffering. And they say that The Katha Upanishad, this is reading from Krishna Book Chapter 2. The Katha Upanishad states that one bird on the tree of the body is eating the fruits and the other bird is simply witnessing. The roots of this tree extend in three directions. That means that the root of this tree is in the three modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. Just as a tree's root expands, so by association of the modes of material nature, one expands his duration of material existence. The material nature, the living entities, are tasting different kinds of religiosity, different kinds of economic development, different kinds of sense gratification, and different kinds of liberation. Practically all material work is performed in ignorance, but because there are three qualities, sometimes the quality of ignorance is covered with goodness or passion. The taste of these material fruits is accepted through five senses. The five sense organs through which knowledge is acquired are subjected to six kinds of whips: lamentation, illusion, infirmity, death, hunger, and thirst. This material body, or the material manifestation, is covered by seven layers: muscle, blood, marrow, bone, fat, and semen. The branches of the tree are eight: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego. There are nine gates in the body, 10 kinds of internal air. The two birds seated in the tree, as explained above, are the living entity and the localized supreme personality of Godhead, Paramatma. So here we are trying to enjoy through our senses. We're trying to taste delicious things, smell beautiful fragrances, see gorgeous things, what do they call them, eye candy, hear pleasant sounds, touch things that are soft and smooth and pleasant to touch. Right? We're trying to enjoy all of our senses, but all of our senses are subjected to lamentation, illusion, infirmity, death, hunger, and thirst. So each of our senses feels a kind of hunger. Each of our senses feels a kind of thirst. Each of our senses is subject to death. Each of our senses is subject to infirmity, to disease, to illusion, and to lamentation. This, of course, includes the mind. So what kind of enjoyment is that? Is that enjoyment? If all of one's means of enjoyment is subjected to such things, how can one say that there's any enjoyment at all? You know, all right, well, you're allowed to enjoy, but you have to enjoy through this filter of infirmity and death and hunger and thirst. And these things are attacking us constantly. Prabhupada says elsewhere that in the Kali Yuga, we're always beset by one of these miseries. And this is very unfortunate. This is not the birthright of the soul. The birthright of the soul is unlimited happiness. Unlimited happiness that expands forever. So we're not meant to have happiness that is mixed with this kind of suffering. We're not meant to have, as Srila Prabhupada would say, and I think Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati also said, sweet rice mixed with sand. You know, if we give you very nice rice pudding and then there's sand mixed in it, that's not very pleasurable, right? You're trying to eat a nice meal. If you've ever sat down to eat a nice meal and there's an argument going on at the dinner table, right? That you're sitting with the family and the family is arguing. So it's not very pleasant, right? Or people in the middle of a war, they're trying to go on with their business, but the enemy is surrounding them. How is there any pleasure in that? And then we can't even trust ourselves. We may be attacked by indefatigable anger, right? Achyuta Rusha. Achyuta is often a name used for Krishna, he who can never be defeated. And it's nice, Arjuna says to Krishna, Achyuta, Senayar Ubayor Madhye, take my chariot between the two armies. And Prabhupada comments that Achyuta there means one who always serves his devotee, one who's never defeated in serving his devotee. But here we're talking about anger that can never be defeated. And I'm sure we all have experience of being overwhelmed by anger, sometimes at very small things, that in retrospect it becomes absurd, or we say, you know, I got in a huge fight with them, I don't even remember what we were fighting about. But indefatigable, when anger takes one over, one becomes a slave of anger, or strong sex urges. People become the slave of lust. They throw away everything. They throw away their family. They throw away their job, their position, their status, their money, just for sexual urges. Sometimes they throw away their health. They're saying now that the sexual diseases, gonorrhea, syphilis, they're becoming resistant to the antibiotics and they're going on the rise. Your whole life is destroyed. Your health is destroyed. So strong sex urges. And Lord Brahma is seeing all this and saying, this is horrible. It's explained elsewhere that on Lord Brahma's planet, there's practically, although Krishna says, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Punaravartin Arjuna, Mama Pecha Chukante Apuna Janman Abhijite, that suffering extends up to the planet of Lord Brahma, still on the planet of Lord Brahma, they don't really have these problems. They don't have to have air conditioning and heaters and it's practically like the spiritual world almost. Their main suffering they have is that they're filled with compassion for the suffering of others in the material world. There's some anxieties. You know, the demons come, what do I do about it, and so forth. And of course they do have death. It's not an eternal position. And it's not their natural swarup. But their main suffering is this compassion. They're filled with compassion. And it's very natural to feel compassion. Compassion is there. It's even visible among the species lower than human beings. At least the parents, especially the mother, has compassion for the children and many, not all. Some of the species, the mother eats the children, but in many of the lower species, the mother will sacrifice her life. Among the elephants, the mother elephant will sacrifice her life for her baby. And the elephants will try to rescue a fallen baby. They have compassion. And even sometimes the animals will show some compassion for a human or some creature of another species. One species will rescue an individual in another species. It's natural. All over the world, people spend huge amounts of money on charity. Prabhupada uses the word voluntarily here. People are not obligated to spend money on charity, to spend money on helping others. Most people want to have more money than they have. They say that almost everybody wants to have 10% more money than whatever they have at present. But still, people are voluntarily giving their money to charity to help others. We all know what it's like to suffer, and we care. Our hearts are moved by others' suffering. And we try various solutions to these sufferings. Most of the solutions that are tried in the world are external. And Prabhupada talks in this purport about the blind leading the blind. We try to separate out the sand from the sweet rice by some external means, put the sweet rice in a machine that will remove the sand. But we don't understand that the problem is at the very core. The problem is at the very root, and therefore it cannot be removed like that. We're basically trying in those attempts just to remove the symptoms. Such is the main thrust of modern medicine. Modern medicine, which is, we could talk a lot about medicine for this verse because it's talking about the dhatus, the three dhatubi, the three humors, mainly mucus, bile, and wind. There's reference here to Ayurveda. So the ancient traditions, which looked at the workings of the body, tried to solve the root of disease by putting the body back in balance. And modern medicine tries to simply attack the symptoms. And very often, the medicines that attack the symptoms create other problems. As Prahlad Maharaj says, the cure is worse than the disease. And I think about my mother, who at the end of life had some serious stomach problems, and when she got rid of 2/3 of the medication she was taking, her stomach problems went away. So it's very common. Somebody will get some treatment or some medicine. And I mean, I had, not that long ago, I had a doctor prescribe some medicine for me where the list of the side effects were almost exactly the same and included more than the condition that it was meant to treat. So here's something for your sore throat, and one of the side effects is sore throat. So that's not very helpful. Right, I use the example all the time that there was an effort to prevent unwanted children. Krishna talks about Varna Sankara, unwanted children. And sociologically speaking, as soon as you have a certain percentage of the population made up of children born outside of marriage, the social fabric of society starts to fall apart. You start having severe crime and so forth. So it's a laudable effort. It's a good effort to want to get rid of unwanted children, to want that all children are born to married couples who desire those children and are going to raise the children with love and affection, what to speak of if they're going to raise the children as God-conscious individuals. All right, so they thought, well, we'll just simply make it possible for people to have sex without there being children. And they started to produce different kinds of contraception and make them widely available. You know, even in 1960, there were many parts of the United States where even a married couple could not get a prescription for contraception. That was in 1960. By the 1970s, contraception had become widely available to anyone, and now it's widely available whether you're married or not, whoever or not. Even contraceptives are being distributed by government and non-government organizations. And then, of course, abortion was made legal. So you think that if there's widespread cheaply available means of contraception and then widespread available abortions, then you would think that the vast majority of children would be born in marriage to people who desire them. But exactly the opposite has happened. And we've gone from 4% illegitimate children in 1960, when even married couples were often prohibited from getting birth control, and now in 2016, we have 40%, a 10 times increase in the amount of children born outside of marriage. And then if you factor in the number of children whose parents divorce and end up not being raised by their biological parents and so forth, the number becomes huge. And so why are we surprised that there's so much drug abuse and depression and crime in society? It should be expected with such a thing. So this is just a very simple example of how the so-called solution actually exacerbated the problem. And we could find many, many examples like this. You know, the people were starving, there wasn't enough food, so there was the Green Revolution of chemical pesticides and fertilizers, and it was going to save the world. And the result has been that the soil has become damaged and people have become ill. So yes, temporarily we produced more food. We forced the earth to produce more food artificially. But in the long run, it simply caused disease and havoc in the whole environment, and in the long run, reduced the capacity of the earth to produce food. So it doesn't work. It doesn't work, whether we're talking about a grandiose scale of a country or a planet, or we're talking about on an individual level. I mean, look, sometimes things work. You cut your finger and you put a bandage on it, and it works. But in the larger scheme of things, as long as we're working within the three modes of material nature, which produce the problem in the first place, then you can't get out of it. As long as one is working within the false ego, that I am the doer, I am the actor, then nothing one does within that mentality is going to solve the problem. Even Einstein said that the solution has to be done in a different consciousness than the problem that you're trying to solve. And so we become frustrated. We try in many different ways, as I was just reading from the Krishna book, you know, different kinds of sense gratification, different kinds of liberation, different kinds of economic development. We'll try capitalism, we'll try communism, we'll try socialism, different kinds of liberation. We'll try to get liberation through drugs, we'll try to get liberation through movies, we'll try to get liberation through 3D movies and IMAX theaters, and we'll try to get liberation through computer games, and we'll try to get liberation by taking a rocket to the moon. We'll try to get liberation through pranayama and asana and yogic practice, whatever. You know, all different, but you don't get rid of the essential false ego, aham mameti, ishwar aham aham bogi siddham. I am perfect, I am powerful, I am happy, I am always right. Then there's no relief. So spiritual life is the real relief, because in spiritual life, we really take care of the root. We really balance everything. And there's a clue here as to the real relief in the word urukrama. And Srila Prabhupada translates this, "O great actor." So one might read this and think, oh, Prabhupada's talking about an actor on a stage. He's talking about... Of course, Krishna is compared like that. It's said that Krishna dresses up like a dramatic actor, a dancer about to perform on a stage. So one could say like that. But that's not the meaning here. Urukrama, it means one who does extraordinary activities, one who does amazing activities. And this is really the cure. The cure is, instead of me trying to do amazing activities, to counteract all of my distresses through some mundane means, that I become absorbed in the person who really does amazing activities and let him counteract everything however he chooses. That's really the solution. To get back, to go down to the root, to give up the idea that I'm going to solve my own problems in my own way. Just leave me alone and let me figure it out. Right? They say that in addiction, the main sign of someone who's addicted is they don't think they're addicted. They say, no, I don't have a problem. I don't even have a problem. Oh, if I have a problem, all right, maybe I have a little problem. Maybe I have a little problem, but you know, I'll figure it out myself. Don't help me. One of my grandchildren recently asked me, she said, Grandma, are most people able to solve their problems without help, or do most people need help to solve their problems? I thought about it. I said, yeah, I think most of us need help to solve our problems. We are not able to save ourselves. So our real relief has to come from help from the great actor, from he who is capable of anything. Is not the being, the person who created this planet, who put the huge banyan tree inside a little seed, who creates all the varieties of life, who spins the planets in their orbits without accidents or collisions, maintains this whole gigantic cosmos. Isn't that person really the one capable of solving my problems and giving me relief? Why should I go to another blind person, another person who is similarly suffering? How are they going to help me? How am I going to help myself when I'm simply blind? I don't even understand the real source of my real problems. I don't even see the nature of the false ego and the envy and the pride and the lust and the anger that is within me. So how am I going to solve them? I have to submit myself to the great physician. I have to submit myself to the great actor and say, you know, I can't do this alone. I need your help. And then we find what is the means of real relief. Of course, this song reminds us very much, Sitoshna, of the song, Vaja Hure Manashri Nandanandana Abhaya Charanaravindare, where also Govindadas is talking about, right? Sita and Ushna, the heat and the cold, serving bad masters. And he say, you know, this is so much suffering for what? For what? And at the end you die. You know? And he says, take shelter of the lotus feet of Srihari, the one who's Abhaya Charanaravindare. And how do you do that? Just to say, we'll take shelter of the great actor, and then one will find relief. So he says, Shravana Kirtana Smarana Vandana Pada Sevana Dasre Pujana Sakitana Atmani Vedana. So just hearing about Krishna. One can achieve full relief just by hearing about Krishna, just by hearing about the activities of the great actor in all of his incarnations, hearing about the activities of his devotees. It's all we have to do. We just hear how Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill, how Krishna was killing Shalva, Shishupal, how he's dancing with the gopis, how he married all the queens, how he allows himself to be defeated by the cowherd boys, how he shows the universal form to Mother Yasoda, how he's fighting with Bhishma, ripping apart Hiranyakashipu and wearing an intestine garland. swimming in the water of devastation, and so many activities, and his devotees, the conflict between Prithu and Indra over the horse sacrifice, the determination of Dhruva, Priyavrata, who gave up his renunciation for service and created a second son, Sati, who gave up her life rather than hear blasphemy of Shiva. So the activities of the devotees in the Bhagavatam, or the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Jagadananda Pandit throwing the container of scented oil, Gadadhar Pandit having to listen to a commentary that the Lord didn't like, the devotees dancing at Rath Yatra, Balabhadra going with Mahaprabhu and seeing the animals chant. Oh, so many. And when we hear about these, whatever activities of the Lord and his devotees, we relish. I'm hearing about Srila Prabhupada, this year's the 50th anniversary of the founding of ISKCON, hearing about Prabhupada going on the Jaladuta with a few dollars. They wouldn't even change his rupees into dollars. And Srila Prabhupada just sitting, having his little classes in the Bowery Loft, sitting in a park in the Lower East Side with a pair of cartels. And the devotees, the current devotees, reading about Jamuna and her steadiness and so forth. So then we feel relief. We feel relief. We become transported to another realm where we are glorifying Urukrama, and we're not trying to be Urukrama anymore. That instead of trying to enjoy through our senses being filtered by lamentation and thirst and hunger, we're using our senses, Rishikena, Rishikena, Sevanam Bhakti Uchite, we're using our senses to serve the real master of the senses. We solve the problem. And then, of course, chanting, talking about Krishna. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said this chanting is the most important item of devotional service. So, of course, that means chanting the holy name, Nam Sankirtan, Japa, Kirtan. It also means talking about Krishna, singing about Krishna, writing about Krishna. Prabhupada wanted his disciples to write something every day, to publish books. And that, again, we find when we talk about Krishna, the troubles of the world go away. We feel relief. We forget. We forget physical pain. We forget emotional pain. We forget our frustrations. They're just gone. They become insignificant, irrelevant. We get our perspective straight. And remembering Krishna, always remember Krishna, never forget him. Remembering Krishna should pervade all of the items of devotion. But one can also, Prabhupada talks about this, memorizing shastras, memorizing verses, meditating on what one reads, meditating on what one hears. And again, we find that when we do that, that there's full relief. It doesn't matter how much money we have in the bank. It doesn't matter what person is criticizing us. I had somebody yesterday write me just message after message after message that was critical, and I just kind of ignored it for a long time. And finally I said, why are you criticizing me? I said, why are you sending me this? I said, why don't you just, you know, get together with other people who don't like me, and you can sit around and criticize me together. You know? But as soon as we remember Krishna, it just goes away. It doesn't matter anymore. Somebody's criticizing me. Somebody doesn't like me. This terrible thing is going to happen, that terrible thing, all of our worries and anxieties and fears. And when we remember Krishna, it doesn't matter. And therefore, Kunti said, you know, she said, Tatra Tatra Jagat Guru. She said, if my miseries are going to push me to think of you and push for you to come, then let there be miseries, because as soon as I think of you, we find all relief. and then worshiping the Lord, the archana process. And to worship Radha Krishna, Gornitai, Jagannath, Shalagram, Giriraj. And that absorbs, especially for the householders. The householders then remember, this is not my house. This is not my family. You know, there's one devotee making all this propaganda against feminism, and he's saying, the wife should serve the husband, but the husband should never serve the wife. And I'm thinking, no, everybody should serve Krishna. Engage your wife in serving Krishna, engage your husband in serving Krishna, engage your children in serving Krishna. And the deities remind us, the food is for Krishna, the money is for Krishna. And then we feel relief. It's not my house. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has such so many nice songs like this. You know, I'm in anxiety about how my wife treats me if I think that she's there for my enjoyment. Oh, she didn't respect me today, but she's my object of enjoyment. Therefore, I feel anger. Or therefore, I feel lust. Or therefore, whatever. But if she's not for my enjoyment, if she's for Krishna's enjoyment, and my duty is to engage her in Krishna's service, then these things are not going to disturb me. So worshiping. And of course, even the Goswamis as renunciates worship the deity. Prabhupada, of course, worshiped deities. And Prabhupada says that the Vaishnava sannyasis, they also engage in worship the deities. But particularly deity worship is for the householders. And serving the lotus feet, serving the devotees. Serving the devotees is so important because it brings us to humility, which conquers the false ego and conquers the whole problem. The whole problem. If we don't serve the devotees just to serve Krishna, then we remain prakriti bhakras. We remain materialistic devotees. So many religions in the world are serving God and not taking care of other living entities. They don't even take care of people in their own religion. They're fighting against the different sects of their own religion and killing each other. Well, you're a Sunni Muslim, let me kill you. You know, you're a Protestant, you're a Catholic, let me kill you. In their own religion. They're not even kind to other living entities. What to speak of living entities who are not in their religion? What to speak of living entities who are not human? They have no compassion. And therefore, the false ego is not basically touched. They're bhaktas, okay, but prakriti bhaktas. So we need to serve the devotees. We need to serve the devotees. A little while ago, one very wonderful, exalted devotee talked about that she might come and stay in my room here for a week or so after when I'm gone. And I was so excited. I was rearranging things and thinking, you know, okay, how would she like it? Then she contacted me. She said, no, I found a place to stay closer to the programs. Okay. But I was so happy. I was so happy thinking, oh, I'm going to be serving this devotee. And then your own problems go away. What can I do for this devotee? Otherwise, we're thinking, what can people do for me? What can people do for me? And that is the best way to please Krishna is by pleasing his devotee. Even in ordinary life, Prabhupada says, love me, love my dog. You want to please someone, you please their children. Try to please somebody directly, it might not work. You please their children, they'll be very happy. And it brings us humility. When we're just serving God, we can think, oh, I'm so great, I'm a servant of God. I'm a great saintly person. Happens all the time. You see this pride in religiousness in all the religions of the world. But when you serve the devotees, that's another thing. And when you serve the devotees who serve the devotees who serve the devotees, you become the servant of the servant. Then you can't maintain your pride. That's not possible. To say, you know, I'm going to just serve the servants. Then the false ego is dismantled. And offering obeisances. That means obeisances and prayers and obeisances physically. Just with the hands, with pranam, or just the what we normally call obeisances, the five-point, or the full dandavat of surrender. And then the prayers of humility, the prayers of longing, reciting the prayers of the acharyas, to get in their mood of humility and love, to imbibe what's the point. Prayer is a dialogue with Krishna. a dialogue with the great acharyas, with the shastras. And again, it gets to the root. When we are singing these songs, when we're falling on the ground, we feel relief. We don't care about the miseries of the world. We're focused again on Krishna. We're focused on the devotees. And then practical service. And we are so fortunate that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in asking us to spread this mission, has given us unlimited service. And because there's unlimited living entities, and he's given us this preaching mission, there is never any end to that service. This mood, what can I do for you? And again, this gives us relief because it puts aside the false ego. That my life is here for the pleasure of others. That I find my pleasure simply in serving others and serving all the living entities, all the living entities, Jivaraswarapaya, Krishnara, Nityadasha, not just the other devotees, not just my family, but all living entities. And there's as many kinds of services as there are mentalities and proclivities and talents. Unlimited. Unlimited quantity, unlimited quality, unlimited variety of service. And friendship, to be Krishna's friend. And there's two varieties of friendship listed in the 64 Angas, and they boil down to, I trust Krishna, and Krishna can trust me. I trust that Krishna is going to solve my problems. Krishna is going to maintain me. Krishna is going to take care of me. He's there for me. And I'm there for him. I'm going to help him with his so-called problems of trying to reclaim the fallen souls. I'm going to keep my promises to him. I'm not going to make excuses. Oh, I vowed to chant 16 rounds, but I'm too lazy, it's too hard, I'm too sick. I vowed to follow four regulative principles, but I was such an attractive woman, I couldn't help myself. Whatever. I was hungry, I ate this, didn't notice if it had eggs in it. So this friendship, keeping my promises to the Lord, that he can trust me, that he can rely on me, that I'm not going to let him down, and having the faith that he's not going to let me down. And that brings us relief because it's establishing our real relationship. All of our suffering is due to a false identity and false relationship, thinking my senses are my friend, my tongue is my friend, my ear is my friend, my eyes are my friend. Oh, Krishna is my friend. And then surrender. All these miseries are due to surrender to the body. My body and mind are my masters. I will do whatever they say. And they are bad masters. These are called whips. All of these miseries, Lord Brahma, they're whips. We have a master who's beating us. You know, we're kind of have the Stockholm syndrome where we've identified with our captors. So we surrender to Krishna. We surrender to the real master. He's maintaining me. He's protecting me. I will do what's pleasing to him. I will not do what's not pleasing to him. I will be in my natural position of humility, and my interests will be in pleasing his interests. And again, this gives us relief because we say to the person who's the entity, whatever, who's abusing us, this body and mind, I'm sorry, I'm divorcing you. I'm not going to serve you anymore. As Jesus said, the wages of sin is death. It's a bad master. And we find the right master. Then we find relief. In that position of relief, and only in that position of relief, we can then help others. If we ourselves are not experiencing this relief, there's no way we can help others. We're still the blind leading the blind. If we're just superficially in bhakti, if we are prakriti bhakta ourselves, and we're still being kicked around by these whips, how can we help others? We'll see the wrong solutions. Of course, we can give them a book. We can say, here's Prabhupada's books. You take it. But Prabhupada would say, you know, you're distributing my books, are you reading them? Are you following them? If someone says to us, is it working for you? And we will, no, I'm not really doing it. Then how are we going to help others? I mean, still, you give someone a book. You could say, I couldn't do it, but at least here's the theoretical thing. Okay. That's worth something. But if we really want to save the suffering of the world, if we're really moved, I think all of us are moved by the suffering of the world, but it feels so overwhelming. There's so much suffering that you just think, what can I do? What difference can I make? How can I really affect anything? But if we ourselves are experiencing this relief, then we do have the ability to give it to others. And even one person, even one jiva that we help is still worth a lot. It makes a difference. Prabhupada would say that he would consider his mission successful if even one person became a pure devotee of the Lord. So this is the way to give relief to the world. Engage people in these processes of devotional service. I mean, from a practical point of view, sometimes in the world you have to put a bandage on a cut finger. We're not saying that no material solution should ever be invoked. We don't say, let your finger bleed while you just sit and chant Hare Krishna. That's foolishness. But we do need to give the ultimate solution to ourselves and to everyone else. And then there are no material miseries. As Krishna says in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, this indeed is freedom from all miseries caused by material contact. They have no meaning. Just like an intoxicated person doesn't notice whether or not they have clothes on, one absorbed in the Lord doesn't even notice whether they have a body. It becomes irrelevant. Questions, comments?
And I have a question that's really been on my mind. I hope you can help me understand this one. When we took initiation back in the relatively early 70s from Prabhupada, it was pretty clear what the vow meant of no illicit sex. It meant in marriage that sex was only for the procreation of children. I have the pleasure of mentoring a lot of younger devotees initiated by other spiritual masters in our line from Prabhupada. But it seems that many of them are told that illicit sex, the vow of no illicit sex means keeping the family and eventually get it under control, eventually give it up. What is the standard?
You're asking something that the GBC itself researched and came up with a very ambiguous conclusion. So considering that the GBC themselves researched it and came up with an ambiguous conclusion, I don't know how much I'm going to venture into this territory. I'd like to just say in principle that with all five of the vows, no illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, and 16 rounds, there is not a clear-cut understanding of what is following and what is not. And there are degrees of following. We tend to focus on the sex one as being, having a range of following, or does it or does it not. But all of them have a range of following. I mean, for example, let's take food. So our vows were no meat, no fish, and no eggs. And sometimes at initiation, Prabhupada would add no onions and no garlic. Sometimes at initiation, he would add and offer everything to Krishna. So what is the vow? Did we vow simply to give up meat, fish, and eggs? I think most of us understand that the food that Srila Prabhupada wants us to eat is not only free from meat, fish, eggs, but also free from onions and garlic, also cooked by devotees. I mean, if we want to take the highest level, we'd say that it would be food that was grown by devotees organically. It was prepared by strictly following second initiated devotees. It was offered at regulated times in a regulated fashion, following the rules of Archanat to installed deities of the Lord, cooked with love and devotion, and was eaten in the mood of service and in the mood of love and devotion. In fact, in the Nectar of Instruction, Srila Prabhupada says that if we eat prasadam just for sense gratification, then we've also fallen under the control of the tongue. So that's, if we want to take what is the highest level of following this vow of no meat, no fish, no eggs, that's the highest level. Do we expect that every single initiated devotee is functioning on that highest level all the time in order to be a devotee in good standing? And the answer to that is a resounding no. I mean, I was at a GBC meeting where they were serving out cornflakes cereal as part of the breakfast prasadam. So I went to the prasadam organizers and said, you shouldn't be serving this. It's grains cooked by non-devotees. Prabhupada says, the Lord Chaitanya says that if we eat grains cooked by non-devotees, our minds become wicked. So they listened to me and they took it away. And then the next morning it was there. And I said, why is it here? They said some of the GBC people complained that it wasn't here. I remember visiting the home of one of the leading preachers in Mumbai. Stayed at her home for quite a while, about 3 weeks, I think. And I didn't say something, but every time she'd bring out, you know, store-bought bread and cornflakes and things like that, I would refuse. And after maybe a week, she said, you don't eat things from outside. I said, no. I said, you know, very rarely in an emergency, but generally no. And she said, you're the first traveling preacher that I've hosted that has that standard. She said, I've hosted hundreds over the years. So I found that interesting. You know, and if somebody's just a vegetarian, would we say that they're keeping their vows? Well, sort of. You know, sort of. If they're vegetarian and they offer all their food, you know, they buy potato chips at the store and they offer it to Krishna, you know, are they keeping their vow? Well, yeah. So we have a range. Let's look at 16 rounds. So what does it mean to chant 16 rounds? Does that mean you move your fingers over the beads and you say some mantra? Suppose you move your fingers over the beads and say the mantra while you're watching a TV show. Have you chanted your rounds? Suppose you move your fingers over the beads and say some mantra while you think about something completely unrelated. Have you chanted your rounds? What does it mean? And in most initiations, Srila Prabhupada talked about the 10 offenses. Do we expect that the day that somebody takes their vows that they are free from offenses? And even to be free from offenses is not the end. Really, chanting rounds, Prabhupada says, is when 16 rounds isn't enough. When you want to chant 16,000 rounds. A devotee said, Prabhupada, how do we know that our japa is of high quality? And that's what he said. That was his answer. So real japa is when you realize there's no difference between the name of Krishna and Krishna. When as soon as you chant, press so many quotes like this all over the place. Prabhupada say when you chant Hare Krishna, immediately Krishna's form, Krishna's pastimes, Krishna's qualities are manifest in your mind. So if someone isn't having that experience, would we say that they're not following their vows? I once asked a leading preacher, I said, what's the highest level of 16 rounds? He said, if all your rounds are finished by 7 in the morning. I was like, wow. No, I said the highest level of 16 rounds is praying Nam. You know, if, just because you're the kind of person who can wake up, you know, at 2 in the morning and have all your rounds done by 5 doesn't mean that that's the highest level of chanting. So there's a range. You know, with intoxication, we can say, well, something's intoxicated or it isn't. But what about electronic intoxicants? What about movies and TV shows? And is that breaking your vows of intoxication? And then what about the most difficult one is gambling. What's gambling? If you start a new business, are you gambling? If you've, you know, you invest your money in the stock market, is that gambling? Is it sometimes gambling and sometimes not gambling? Sometimes Prabhupada would put prajapa in the gambling category. If you talk gossip, have you broken your initiation vows? So what does it mean? And I see with illicit sex, there's a range. I mean, there's some, obvious illicit sex, the sex outside of marriage. And then even that, there's a range. You know, there's horrible activities, bestiality, pedophilia, horrific illicit activities, rape and incest. And so that's at the very bottom. And then at the very top, there's, you have sex only in marriage with a pure consciousness, like Kasyapa and Aditi, where they're calling the form of the Lord, Kardama Muni and Devahuti, you have an incarnation of God that comes as your child, Bhakti Vinod and his wife, and you have a ray of Vishnu, and your motive for having sex, the sexual act itself, the whole relationship between the husband and wife are on the transcendental platform. That's the highest level. Prabhupada compares sex in marriage like that to prasadam, the same principle. So, and then you have, the lowest platform is at least you're married and you're not using contraceptives, and whatever children come, you welcome them. Prabhupada did specifically say contraception is demoniac. And Prabhupada gave, again, different instructions at different times to different people. He'd say, keep it within marriage, and he'd say as far as possible, but don't use any contraception. So, there's a range. And you can't, if you say that only those people, even, let's talk about the celibate ashram. So there's 8 kinds of celibacy. So never thinking about, never planning about, like after Junior Haridas was rejected by Mahaprabhu, it said his associates didn't think of sex even in dreams. So how many renunciates are going to say they never think of sex even in dreams? How many renunciates are going to say they never think about sex? Or that there's no subtle sex? I mean, let's be real here. So I've seen so many people in the renounced ashrams that are obviously trying to attract the opposite sex, at least on a subtle platform, and are pulling some subtle emotional energy from the opposite sex. See it a lot. It's very common. In fact, it's more common than uncommon. If we're honest. So to say that everybody has to be at the highest level in sex, but not everybody has to be at the highest level in japa is I think it's kind of ridiculous. If we say that the second you take initiation, you have to be chanting Prem Nam, nobody would be able to ever take initiation. So there's a range. And that was true even when Prabhupada was here, if you read Prabhupada's letters and Prabhupada's instructions. And if we're wise, we see what is the bottom level of that range, what is the top level of that range, where am I right now, and go up. No, don't get so close to the bottom that you're likely to fall off a cliff. Don't say, okay, well, this is the absolute minimum standard. I don't eat meat, fish, and eggs, but I don't even offer my food. You're going to fall off a cliff. Fine. Have the minimum standard that you're absolutely not going to break that minimum standard. Pick the highest level you can function at comfortably in all the vows. And then go up. Keep improving your japa. Keep improving your detachment from sex life. Keep improving your, giving up anything that intoxicates your ego, that illusions you. Any gambling also means trying to make money dishonestly, having some cheating way of making money, taking money from others without giving them anything in return. How many people do things like that as their livelihood? So to become more and more scrupulously honest, And also Prabhupada said, be strict with yourselves and lenient with others. So let us each in our own life become free from all, even subtle sex desire, even profit adoration and distinction. Any desire to enjoy the opposite sex in an improper way, to pull energy from the opposite sex in an improper way. Let us each examine our lives with a microscope and ask Krishna, am I trying to pull the sexual energy of others for my own gratification in any way at all in the name of service? Bhakti Vinod Thakur talks about this in depth in his commentary to Manashiksha. And let me be free from that. Let me never have an exploitive mentality towards anyone. That's giving up illicit sex. That's giving up illicit sex. You know, really. Seeing anyone as a sense, hating others as a sense object. You know, these people who are celibate but hate women, I'll tell you, that's illicit sex. They're seeing women as their sense objects, or hate men, depending on who they are, whatever they are. They're seeing these people as their sense objects, and they're so angry at their own lust that they project that anger onto the object, onto the jiva in that body. That's illicit sex. They're still trying to enjoy. But if I see all other living entities as belonging to Krishna, just like Prabhupada at least one time said, the men should see all the women as Krishna's gopis for his enjoyment, that's giving up illicit sex. And then whether you're married or unmarried, whether you're having children or not having children, is not really very important. What's important is you never see anyone as an object of satisfying your own lust, on a subtle platform as a gross platform. So generally that takes time. That's not generally an overnight endeavor. Even if externally you're at the highest platform on a gross level, you know, the enjoying mentality is really what needs to be eradicated. We have here a devotee called Nervous One. That's an interesting name for devotee. I assume it's not an initiated name. Nervous One. So Nervous One says, you mentioned animals showing compassion. Does that mean they're briefly experiencing a higher mode of nature? Sure, even within the animals, the animals are not entirely in ignorance. And of course, different species have different degrees of ignorance. This is true even among the plants. So, you know, plants with thorns and poisonous leaves are more in ignorance than plants that produce beautiful flowers and fruits. You have a tree outside here, Pakland, where even the leaves are fragrant. So there's degrees of modes, even among the plants, even among the insects. You know, the honeybee, when you compare the honeybee to the wasp, the honeybee to the mosquito, the butterfly to the fly. So there's degrees in all of the species, and some species have more of a touch of the higher modes. So yeah, sure, and they're influenced, the animals are influenced by the modes just as we are. Different modes are active at different times of the day, different times of the year, different parts of the planet. And of course, yes, that is definitely there. Although generally, the living entity in an animal body is just, their ability to exercise free will is very circumspect. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna, Mother Irmala, that was a fantastic class, but the answer you just gave was an even better answer than your class. So, you might hang up on me, but if Srila Prabhupada said eating, we'll just say karmic grains to keep from that whole long description, eating karmic grains makes the mind wicked, and the GVC eats karmic grains, does that mean the GVC is wicked?
You know what? That's not a question for me.
No, it was kind of a joke, actually.
The point is, my point in bringing that up, is that it's very easy to go around saying everybody has to be at the absolute highest standard. You know, initiation means to initiate, means to begin. So to say everybody has to absolutely be at the highest standard in everything at every moment, then you have a whole society of uttam bhaktas. That means as soon as you walk in the door, as soon as you take your vows, you're already at prema. It's not reasonable. It's not reasonable. As far as what other people do and what other people have, Hare Krishna. You know, let's each try to deal with our own demons, shall we? And we can present the principle. So Harsh is asking, what's the bottom line of devotional service? What makes something devotional service? You say the top line is Anya Bilasita Sunyam. No, that's the bottom line of bhakti. The bottom line of bhakti, what makes it the bottom line, is that you're aspiring for Anya Bilasita Sunyam. That's your goal. That's your goal. You're coming to Krishna with the goal that I want to serve you just for your own pleasure. If you're coming to Krishna even as a beginner and you're saying, Krishna, I'm serving you because I want to go to heaven. I'm serving you because I want to be rich. I'm serving you because I want to be liberated. That's not bhakti. It's not pure bhakti. It's not uttam bhakti. It's gyan nishra bhakti, karma nishra bhakti. Or it may even just be karma yoga or gyan yoga. It's not really bhakti. But if at least you desire to desire, or you desire to desire to desire, the Krishna, my ultimate goal is to serve you with love without selfish interest. Right now I'm full of selfish interest. I was just hearing this class of Prabhupada yesterday and today where he was saying one should not chant for liberation. And I was thinking, oh, how much have I chanted for liberation? You know, there's this song by Bhaktivinoda Thakur where he says, you know, I've never done any service for you. I have no service for you. I don't even know what service is. There's many prayers like that. I have no credit of devotional service. I don't even know what pious activities are. All right, let's see if I can find that because it's so well said. Yeah, so Bhaktivinoda Thakur here, he says, oh, my Lord Hari, enthusiasm in devotional service, faith in the process of devotional service, the treasure of patience in the attainment of love of God, performing activities favorable to pure devotion, abandoning the company of worldly people, performing approved devotional practices. I have never possessed these six devotional qualities, O Lord. How then shall I give up my affinity for Maya and worship your lotus feet? Remaining absorbed in abominable activities, I never kept company with sadhus. Now I adopt the garb of a sadhu and act out the role of instructing others. This is Maya's big joke. O Lord Hari, in such a helpless condition, surely I will receive your causeless mercy. Or when, under the shelter of my spiritual master, will I call out to you with my humble entreaty? So often people have false confidence when they come and they think, yes, I'm a pure devotee. I'm going to be a pure devotee in 5 minutes. I have no material desires. I just want to serve Krishna. And as one goes on chanting, one will see all the material desires in one's heart. And one will see, I'm not really serving Krishna purely at all. I'm serving Krishna just for bhakti and mukti. But the desire is to somehow or other, I want to be a devotee. That is the bottom line of pure devotional service. And having faith that only bhakti will save me, not karma and gyan, trying to do things that are favorable for Krishna, that is the bottom line. Actually fully doing that all the time is the top line. But at least the desire to do that, the commitment to doing that, that is the beginning of bhakti. Even if one is a total failure, it's just like the beginning of learning to walk as the child stands up. They don't stand up very long. Sometimes I have to stand up holding on to something. It doesn't last very long. But that's the beginning of learning how to walk. As soon as that child stands up for the first time, they're trying to walk. They're going to fall over and over, but their desire is to walk. And that's when it begins. Does walking begin when they're running around the room? No. That's not the beginning. So at least the commitment to Anya Bilasita Sunyam Ganakama Anavrita. that is bhakti. Anything else is not bhakti. It's something else. And it will take a very long time. So we're running out of time here. We have some... even the desire for desirelessness is to be overcome. Yes, we want to have a desire for just serving Krishna. We can choose who we want to associate with Vidugdha Madhava and who we want to be like. Our ideal should be high. Yes, our ideal should be high. We should keep the highest ideal always above our heads, always. Always striving. And I'm going to tell you something that I hope will not be discouraging. We will never think, I have achieved the highest ideal. It's dynamic. If you want to get to the point where you think, now I've achieved the highest ideal, go to the Brahman. But when we're going to Krishna, there's always further and further and further and further. As soon as the gopis thought, oh, we have achieved the highest ideal, he said goodbye. We want a dynamic relationship of love. Of course, it comes to a point where one understands, by Krishna's grace, by Guru's grace, I'm no longer under the control of the material nature. As Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, you have made a crow into Garuda. He said, my dear Lord, to save the whole world, that is not a very big accomplishment for you, but to save the Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, that is a very big accomplishment. So he knew he had been saved. We do reach a point where we understand I've been saved. I'm no longer a slave to these whips of lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, and madness. Prabhupada would say, why is everyone adoring me? He said, because I have no sex desire. So there's a point that one understands. I'm no longer influenced by these things. But you never reach a point where you say, now I'm perfect. Prabhupada would never say, now I'm perfect. He said, I'm perfect because I'm repeating the perfect, because I'm following the perfect. That's my perfection. He said, myself, I am imperfect in so many ways. Without that, there's no love. Without humility, without dynamism, without expansion, it's not love, it's just static. So always to have that in mind. Then we're in bhakti. Regardless of my heart may be filled with material desires, but because I'm striving for a love free from material desires, then I'm in bhakti. I'm in the shower. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.